This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine conflict and strikes inside Russia in these last hours. The news is a third Russian airfield hit by drone, reports Bloomberg, as Moscow accuses Ukraine. Subhead, oil tank at Kursk regional airfield on fire after strike. I welcome Patrick Tucker, the technology editor of Defense One, who has written about the earlier strikes at two air bases within Russia, both associated with missile attacks on Kyiv. That is not clear yet, this third airfield, but nevertheless, we go to how the Ukrainians are doing this and what it means for the restrictions that heretofore have been placed on the Ukrainian forces about striking into Russia. Patrick, a very good evening to you. What is the weapon the Ukrainians are using to strike so deep into Russia? Good evening.
Good evening. So Ukrainians haven't had a comment on this yet. I talked to some folks. There are a couple of options. One option is that it's Ukrainian special operations forces that were firing short range inside the country. Another is a modified Iranian Shahid 136 drone, that the type that Russia has been firing into Ukraine. But the most likely is a thing called the Tupolev Tu-141. It's a Soviet-era reconnaissance drone. So it's very short wings, and it flies about 20,000 feet up, top speed of about 600 miles an hour, runs with a big old KR-174 turbojet on the back of it. They only used it during the Soviet Union times as target practice and for reconnaissance. It would fly over a place, take a bunch of pictures. The pictures weren't good, and with satellite imagery, you wouldn't even use those anymore. But what the Ukrainians have done is outfitted what they seem to have done, like open source analysis, and there's a consensus of it suggests what they seem to have done is outfit this thing with GPS navigation so you can guide it like a precision rocket, like a cruise missile, some munitions, probably not a ton of munitions, which is why the damage that you're seeing out of Ingels and Dyagivlo is pretty constrained. They hit a couple of big Russian Tu-95 bombers, but we don't know it's not an enormous amount of damage. But the key thing here is that they flew these from within Ukrainian controlled territory more than 372 miles into Russia. And that puts essentially Moscow within range with this sort of thing. Now, these are both military targets. It looks like the most recent one was also a military target. Ukrainians have never said that they were going to try and conduct strikes on Moscow. But that is significant because the U.S. has said that they were very reluctant to give Ukraine weapons like ATACMS, very long-range weapons that would let them hit into that far into Russia and potentially put Moscow under threat because of risks of escalating the war and because of their reading of Russian nuclear doctrine. The Ukrainians are very happy for all of the Gimlers and other shorter range rockets they can get from the U.S., but they don't seem to be quite as intimidated by some folks' read of Russia's nuclear doctrine. They seem pretty happy to range as deeply into Russia as they need to, and they're being very precise in their targeting. They're hitting legitimate military targets, bombers that would be carrying munitions that would be dropped on Ukraine.
There's a photograph that accompanying your story at Defense One, a photograph from the Russia's Central Air Force Museum in Manino, dateline 2006. It's a photograph of what you identified as the Tu-141 reconnaissance drone. It is striking to me on first glance that it looks exactly like a V-1 rocket. This looks like what Germany invented to attack the invasion fleet in 1944.
Yeah, exactly. It is basically a big rocket. And there are, at least as of 2014, it's believed that there are about 68 of these in Ukraine still. So they have plenty that they can work with. But Ukraine has said that they're also trying to make their own version of a long-range cruise missile, which isn't when you have GPS, when you have guidance, you have the proper propellants and things like that. It's not as large of a lift as it used to be. So expect more of this, I think. I think that that's the message that the Ukrainians are trying to to send, because this is a messaging weapon as much as it is anything else, that, you know, your efforts, Russia, to reinforce your line, to resupply your line through the winter, we can mess with that as easily in Crimea, as easily in Zaporizhia, as we can 122 miles southeast of Moscow. And it's an important message.
The puzzle here, if they can strike that close to Moscow with an ancient weapon, they can certainly strike that close to Moscow with modern weapons. So what exactly is the hesitation now by Washington? These three attacks have happened and the world has not ended. Nuclear weapons have not been rattled out. What is the next step?
Well, and that is the thing. So Russia has said back in September that were the United States to give Ukraine missiles that could range to Moscow, they would view it as a red line, and then they would be the U.S. would be drawn into the conflict. And I think it's also worth pointing out that the United States has actually played this, some might say conservatively. Some others say that they've been unashamedly a part of the conflict, but they've walked a very delicate balancing act, and it has actually worked out for them. You have a situation where the United States is able to use its inventory of weapons that were basically designed one day to potentially fight a war with Russia, but it now being used by a party that is engaged in that act of war with Russia without putting U.S. service people on the line. When the United States becomes a party to this conflict, if that were to happen, and it's something that the Pentagon to the White House have all said that they are intent to see not happen, to not happen under any circumstances, then you have the potential of a much larger conflict, something that gets really messy and almost certainly employs some sort of weapon of mass destruction in whatever form, because Russia is so decimated militarily. As long as this remains a fight between Ukraine and Russia, with the U.S. supplying Ukraine, then you have the Pentagon and the White House believe escalation management. And they're not going to lose their focus on that escalation management. They spent a lot of time developing this particular framework that they feel like allows them to supply Ukraine without getting directly involved. They feel like it's working. And the evidence suggests that even though, you know, Ukraine keeps asking for more things, they are showing a lot of success here with the stuff they've been given. But yes, to your point, there's a lot of agreement that if they had these attack-ems, they could reinforce their line further back. You could strike a lot more Russian positions. You would end the war faster. And that there is a consensus about that, too. So it comes at a cost, this escalation management.
What the U.S. is sending to Ukraine, this is Patrick's reporting, are generators. This dated as the beginning of the takedown of the electric grid, and anti-drone machine guns. Now, I've not seen an anti-drone machine gun recently. I did see a German anti-air defense system that spins around magically and apparently fires fairly large shells that take down the Shahed 136. Is that what we're sending also, machine guns that are designed to take down the Shahed?
Yeah, that would be their primary use. So this is November 23rd, part of the a more recent announcement of from the Presidential Drawdown Authority. So these include that included more National Advanced Surface to Air Missile Systems, or NASAMS. And yes, these machine guns that can be used to shoot down drones like the Shahids, which are causing like a lot of problems. This thing is, you know, on top of some of the other things that Ukraine is trying to do to develop anti-drone air defenses, basically. We know that the Pentagon is also looking at things like big microwaves, basically shoot the air with microwaves to take down swarms of drones. We know that there are discussions about that, but really the last thing that Ukraine needs is an air defense system that costs too much to deploy against these cheap Iranian drones. So you can't have NASAMs that are very expensive shooting down every cheap Iranian drone that comes over. You certainly can't have like F-16s or something like that try to take them down, because you're putting your F-16s at risk. So these big machine guns are kind of the best thing that they've figured out so far to send them. But it's a huge problem for the Ukrainians. Are these cheap drones? Because, of course, Russia uses them to target the energy sector. It doesn't have a military effect. It's just pure sort of terror on the Ukrainian people.
All right. We've gone through the weapons fighting. There's one more detail before we come to major policy, which is lessons learned so far in the Ukraine conflict by the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, one of them is that if you've used old Soviet equipment, you can strike into Moscow. There's a lesson learned, as opposed to U.S. equipment. But the head of the DIA, the General Lieutenant General Scott Barrier, is saying an important lesson is our intel was good, but it wasn't good. Explain, please, Patrick.
Right. So, you know, the administration and the Defense Department have spent a lot of time talking about the intelligence that led up to the war, and some of that intelligence was used to tremendously positive effect, basically laying out Russia's plans and their pretense for this action before it ever happened. That helped Ukraine to get in much better position. It certainly helped them develop resiliency in their IT systems, and it helped rally the world to sanctions and imposing costs on Russia. But one of the things that Washington missed, and I think particularly DIA, was that the Russian military was maybe a little bit softer than fable would have you believe, and the Ukrainians were quite a bit harder. So this comes to light because Barrier is standing up a new China mission group. So he's basically coordinating all the different assets that they have at DIA. Some are doing human intelligence, some are doing technological intelligence. They're looking at all the different aspects of the problem of China. He's putting them together in one special group, and he's telling them, okay, now we have to learn from Ukraine so that we don't run into the same problem that we did with when we look at China, so we don't run into the same problem that we did when we looked at Ukraine. And under testimony, he's talked about how basically he said, my view was based on a variety of factors that the Ukrainians were not as ready as I thought they would be. I told this to the Senate Armed Services Committee in May. And therefore, I questioned their will to fight. That was bad assessment on my part. They have fought bravely and honorably and are doing the right thing. So the question, when you apply that same rubric to Taiwan, is how willing are they to fight and how do you assess that? We know that they have a defense concept. We know that Taiwan is building up the same sort of asymmetric capabilities that would have been really helpful to had Ukraine had them, long-range fires, mines, sea mines in this case, things like that. But that question of how do you assess the will to fight, this is something that the United States military and intelligence community really have to do some soul searching on, because they kind of missed that in the Ukraine and Russia conflict. They missed first, they bought too much brand advertising from the Russian military on how effective all of their stuff was, because the Russian military had spent a lot of money on military modernization, but they also missed that Ukraine wasn't Afghanistan. It wasn't some of these other places that U.S. has been involved in over the last few years, that it was a place that was determined to remain free.
Patrick Tucker is the technology editor of Defense One. We're going to turn to not only lessons learned, but attendance at the Halifax International Security Forum. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.